Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Rad Gontos, where is he? Oh, he's not here. Everybody's listening to the show knows he comes waltzing in about 10 minutes after the show starts here. So, you know, that's what happens when you're a diva, when you're a big famous star. This is Paul Roberts, his trusty sidekick, inviting you to tweet us your questions today as we're talking with Dr. David Walling, as he's going to discuss psychiatry and neurology research. Welcome to the show, Dr. Walling.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So you got to explain to me. I have no idea. That sounds way over my pay grade here. Psychiatry and neurology research. What the heck do you do?
So what we do is we do the trials for drugs to be approved prior to them being approved by the FDA. So there's a certain number of clinical trials and different types of trials that have to be done in order for a medication to be approved. And if you look at most of the psychiatry drugs that have been approved over the last 25 years, I or our company, CNS, has worked on those.
Really? Okay, so would that include, like, I think I've taken, I'll confess, I'm always exposing myself on the show, I've taken Paxil on and off for anxiety, and it's something I seem to have inherited from my mom, and I get wound up, and so I take that. Is that something, those kinds of drugs? Those are
exactly. So Paxil's a drug that was approved in the 1990s, and it was actually one when I was in my prior position at the University of Texas Medical Branch teaching medical school. It was one that we worked on there.
Oh, okay. All right. Is it a good drug? Am I doing okay here?
it is a good drug.
They're rolling their eyes at Paxil. Oh, you take a Paxil. Okay. So they come to you to do the trials because they have to have an arm's length. Obviously, the manufacturer, I guess, can pay for it, but they can't do the trial themselves because it would be suspect, the results, right?
Exactly. So what happens is the pharmaceutical companies develop a medication and put it through what's called preclinical trials. So that's oftentimes done in animal models or computer models and things like that. And then eventually what happens is they move into the human trials. And when they move into human trials, that's actually when we start working with the medications. And the FDA really wants it to be separate from the pharmaceutical company themselves. So we're the company, or we're one of the companies in the country that actually does those trials.
And how often does the trial fail? They've developed all this stuff. They got all the wizardry behind it. And you come in, you say, sorry, this is just not panning out. This is not showing you the results you want here. Is that happening?
It happens a lot. So about one out of every 100 drugs that goes into human trials will actually be approved.
One in 100?
Yes.
And oh, my goodness.
If you look at the failure rate for Alzheimer's, trials in Alzheimer's disease, it's over a 99% failure rate for drugs that have entered the later phases.
Because we're always hearing about how difficult it is approved drugs, and I don't know, we won't get into too deeply in the political discussion. I guess I look like an old hippie, so I'm more of the liberal persuasion. I like these things, but I understand that there's probably, doesn't it take like $1 billion or some crazy number to get a drug from start to market here?
Yeah, so these days we say it's between $800 and $1.2 billion to get a drug to market. So $1 billion is a pretty accurate figure. It depends on the type of drug that's being approved.
And therefore, our pharma companies say, well, that's why we get charged so much, because we have so many failures and it costs so much to do this. And I'm sorry, it's, what was the pill they had on the current president was so wound up about, there was some pill on the market, and it was, I don't know, $10,000 a pop or something or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was there was a new drug for Duchenne disease that was approved that, right, they were going to charge quite a bit for.
And so everybody gets wound up about this. Well, look who's wound up and walked in. We must have caught him. He's down in the lobby tweeting here, and he decided to join us. Rod Gontos.
I wasn't tweeting.
Looking sharp as always.
I was dealing, hey, Women's Day.
International Women's
Day. Where's your writ?
It's my underwear. I'll show it to you, but you'd be embarrassed.
You know what? That's a visual that I really didn't need today.
Oh, okay.
Or any day, actually. No, I was actually, I had a meeting. We're doing a three-story, 80,000-square-foot memory care facility in Stanton.
How cool is that?
And so we were talking about some stuff with the operator. and relevant to just quality of life.
Bring them in.
Enhancements and stuff like that. Well, I'm not happy with them yet.
Ah, okay.
And I won't mention who they are. but basically, the reason why I'm not is, you know, we deal with this on the show all the time about how, you know, it's about enhancement, quality of life.
Yeah.
And so,
not just minimum standards, like you always talk about the ADA. Too many builders.
That's where you start. Yeah. Minimum standards is where you start.
No, that's where they want to stop. They want to stretch to get to the minimum. And, I got to do how many of these? I'll do two of them.
Well, yeah. And unfortunately, when you do that, you basically miss out on opportunity that basically positions you in the market in a different manner.
Right.
And all of this stuff, people forget that all of this stuff is coming out of savings. Like a very little of it is covered by insurance, so it's basically very much, if you will, elective expenditure, elective spending, right?
Certainly, so, you could elect where you do it and when you do it, because you drag it out as long as
you can. And it comes down to price point, but at the same time, there's also a little bit of guilt involved, and you know, where people are leaving family member or something, and there's sort of that idea of, you know, I really need to give a little bit better environment for mom and dad or whatever.
Right.
So anyway, one of the things that we were talking about, which, you know, we haven't resolved yet, is, for example, their approach is that, well, you know, every floor should have a dining room that will basically accommodate everybody who's on that floor.
Right.
We do not want to transfer anybody
for efficiency.
Well, there's a slight problem. Unless you dedicate the upstairs floor to acute care, which really cannot be moved.
Right.
There are people that are going to be on the third floor looking down on the second floor patio with the gardens and all the activities outside and saying, why am I Rapunzel in the tower when everybody else is outside enjoying the sunlight?
I want to be down there. Yeah.
Right. Plus, we talked about, well, and are you guys going to incorporate, like, family members coming in for meals?
Wow.
Or is this just basically one large dining room that has laminated countertops on it with, you know, name placement or something?
Right. Family members, once we stick you in the box there, we never want to come see you again here.
See, that's the whole problem, though.
Yeah.
Right?
Because we warehoused you. Now take care of it.
Because here's the thing. You're still paying for it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's when, you know, you have that detachment and they have isolation and all the stuff we talk about. So anyway, it was interesting. I apologize for being late, but we were talking about this thing, and it's interesting where people that are in positions of care that are well-intentioned are so inside their own box of how they do things that they do not look beyond. Right, and I was looking at what we're doing here today, which is talking about some of these, you know, very necessary sort of trials to further some of this stuff, right, and relevant to, you know, when we're talking about depression, we had people over here, we're talking about depression, over medication, you know, this isn't something that usually people associate with seniors, but it is very much an ageless problem.
My mother was a drug addict. She didn't mean to be, but in her latter years.
I'm very proud of you. That's the second time in two weeks that you just
stood
up and said hello.
My dad would roll over his grave and fought that idea, but she was on so many medications from so many different doctors for so many things, some of which who had long since died, and she stayed on the medication, and we'd ask, why is she on this medication?
I don't know.
Yeah, like Valium. She was on Valium for 20 years, and one guy said, she's so addicted to it, I'm not going to even try taking it.
I don't want to be the one that brings her down from it.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, let's go back to, we were finishing the story of clinical trials here, and the cost of bringing a drug to market is around $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And the failure rate, he was saying, in Alzheimer's alone is like 99% of the ones that come to trials fail.
But how is that compared to, I mean, Alzheimer's is the focus today, but I mean, if you look back historically at medical trials and you look at situations where there were failure rates, obviously, mm-hmm. and it's understandable until you get to a success, how does that compare?
So the issue there is, in other areas of medicine, we actually have good animal models. So we can look at hypertension and give a drug to an animal and see that it drops the blood pressure. We can look at cancer in a petri dish and try a medication and see how
it
affects.
Kills the cell. Yeah, right.
Exactly. But with Alzheimer's, it's different because we don't have good animal models for Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way to really test the efficacy of a medication for Alzheimer's mm-hmm. is to actually try it in people that have the disease or are prone to the disease, which is some of what you've heard lately. People are moving earlier in the disease process.
Right.
But that may be too late because by the time Alzheimer's is diagnosed, people have had symptoms for probably 7 to 10 years before mm-hmm. that. And they probably had plaques forming in the brain for mm-hmm. about 25 years. So it may be that the
medication... Hard to cure at that point here, yeah.
Yeah, it may be that we're starting the treatment way too late in the process.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you...
Why do you think... I'm sorry, Paul. Yeah. Why do you think that is? I mean, is it... I mean, I know there's a big effort to basically early diagnose. Is it, what specifically, and I would think relevant to like memory or dementia or Alzheimer's, that those are sort of very sensitive things. So is that working against that early detection? I mean, who's that first line that should basically be picking up on it?
Boy, that's a tough one. I mean, Alzheimer's is probably, there's a genetic component. Mm-hmm. We know that if people that are APOE4 positive, so a particular gene variant in the body, if you're positive for that, you're more likely to develop Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So there is that genetic component, so it tends to run in families. If you saw the 60 Minutes that was done on the group of people, I think it was in South America, there's a whole area of families that have developed Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. early onset Alzheimer's, in their 40s even. Mm-hmm. So there is that genetic component, but I also think, you know, it's not something, we don't think about it developing in somebody that's 40 or 50 years old, even though it does, but most of the general public, we don't want to think about that. We think about it as something that happens when you get older, mm-hmm. when you're 70 or 80 years old. Mm-hmm. So people aren't really thinking that that's potentially Alzheimer's.
So is that likely to change, for example, like early detection of breast cancer, you know, with enhancements and improvements and, you know, sort of that awareness factor? Are we likely to see that, or is that age element still going to be sort of a deterrent?
So there's lots of biomarkers that are starting to come about. So as I mentioned, the APOE4 gene is one potential biomarker. We can look at the brain to look to see if plaques are starting to form in the brain. So I think we're moving to a point where earlier diagnosis will mm-hmm. be possible. The problem is, do you want to know that you have a disease?
Yeah, exactly.
If there's nothing we
I
can
don't
do.
Want to
that
know
was
what?
My next question.
You might get it.
Does that early detection mean anything in terms of increasing my chances to deal with it? What does it mean if there's no cure, there's no...
At the moment, it probably doesn't. Now... At the moment, we don't have medications that really seem to help with that. There are medications that are in development, and that's what pretty much every pharmaceutical company, it's kind of the holy grail in mm-hmm. pharmaceutical research right now.
That's the big one.
Is finding a cure for Alzheimer's disease. And so there are drugs we've started to look earlier in the process of Alzheimer's. So what we call MCI, mild cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. And we've even had studies that were done in patients who were not even diagnosed with MCI but had a propensity for Alzheimer's disease. So exhibited some of these biomarkers that I mentioned. And in that case, we might try the new medication in them.
Paul, I got to interrupt for 1 second. Everybody keeps saying phone call in. If you have any questions, we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's and other diseases like this today with people who are on the front lines researching the latest and greatest stuff. So if you got some questions, this is a place to start. The call-in number for anybody who wants is, ready, 949-330-7761. That's our direct studio line, 949-330-7761. Or, of course, you can tweet us at OC Talk Radio, and we'll try and work in your questions. Having said that, I have a question. My mother and father, anybody who's listening to the show, died several years ago. I'm the poster child for baby boomers. I went through all this dealing with these issues that I never wanted to face or deal with or whatever, taking care of parents, figuring out how to pay for all this, wiping my parents' butt as they got older, and all the things that I wasn't set to do. One of the things that upset me a great deal, and my father, was that my mother seemed to suffer from Parkinson's. Was it, but nobody could ever say it was Parkinson's because there was no clinical proof or no test for Parkinson's. It was all observation. She shook a lot, and she exhibited a lot of the symptoms. But we also have what's called familiar tremor that runs in our family. I have it today. You'll see my hand shaking. And so was it just that gone crazy, or had it moved into real Parkinson's? We debated about that. We seem to be developing these kinds of diseases. Maybe it's because we're living longer than we ever have, that there is no proof that you have it. It looks like you have it. I guess it doesn't matter whether you have it, but if you don't really have it, I don't know that a drug would work for it.
Yeah, so you bring you bring up a great point, which is if you look at some of the earlier studies that were done on Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. particularly those that had imaging involved, mm-hmm. what you see is that about 30% of the patients that were in the studies probably did not meet what we would consider the actual criteria to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. They probably had a dementia, but it may not have been Alzheimer's dementia.
Exactly, right.
So
you're saying, I'll just round it up, so you got Alzheimer's seems to fall in the same category as Parkinson's, where it's very devastating, but it isn't like cancer. You don't take a blood test, and say, oh, you got this.
You didn't used to be able to.
Okay.
So We've gotten better with being able to diagnose. We can actually inject some tracers into the brain that will show us the amyloid plaques. Mm-hmm. So in the old days, it was called a probable diagnosis of Alzheimer's, because you could only diagnose Alzheimer's truly post-mortem, after the person had died and you had a chance to look at the brain. Now you can actually inject something and do – it's a very expensive test, though, right now, and Medicare does not cover it in most cases. So, but you can inject this tracer and actually see the amyloid plaques in the brain and do an actual diagnosis.
So imagine the insanity of this, and I'll shut up here. Imagine the insanity. So your loved one is exhibiting signs of dementia. They say, I think it's Parkinson's. I think it's Alzheimer's. And this gentleman over here is testing drugs day and night for drug companies that are the holy grail, trying to find the answer to Alzheimer's. Hooray, we found the answer to Alzheimer's. Take this pill. Didn't work, because you didn't have Alzheimer's. There's no proof that you had it. It could have been one of 8,000 other kinds of dementia, either that we've figured out or haven't figured out.
Yeah, but there's a bigger question, and it sort of echoes almost the model that was almost unconscionable last year with the pill for cancer, you mm-hmm. know? All right, okay, fine.
Go ahead.
We kind of just touched on it a little bit in terms of the cost, right? I mean, if we're going through all of this, and it's very expensive to do these clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
okay, the likelihood of finding a cure, let's say we do, right? How's it going to be affordable? I mean, at that point, what happens? Because, I mean, this is the thing also, and sort of with currently what's being discussed in terms of healthcare coverage and changing the model and all this stuff, you got a growing population of seniors.
Yes.
That are, even if we just believe in the age component, are going to be more likely to suffer and deal with this stuff. But yet, at the same time, their financial resources are less and less. So what, I mean, we're going through all of this, and my question is, why when we can't afford it, when it comes down to it? I mean,
we got the cure, but you can't afford it.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you you're likely to have Alzheimer's. I'm going to tell you early, I don't have a cure for you. And then when I have the cure for you, you might not be able to afford it, or it won't be covered. So,
or my insanity is, we think you got Alzheimer's.
Are we looking at this whole thing in such a twisted manner? I mean, at the end of the day, it's the end user's benefit, right?
Yes. So the one thing I will say is, some of the medications that you've heard talked about that have come to market with these really high price tags are for what we call orphan diseases, where there's not a lot of people that are actually diagnosed with that disease. And so the way that some of these pharmas make up that is by creating high prices.
Charging a lot.
Smaller market, large price point.
But with Alzheimer's, you're talking about, I mean, there's going to be over 50% of the population, you know, above age 75 that will develop Alzheimer's. We're living longer. You're talking about a huge market here. So hopefully what will happen is, you know, it's a larger market. Prices will be lower than it would be for an orphan disease drug. But
again, don't we have to prove the diagnosis process? Because we may be developing a drug to cure something, but we don't know who's got it.
Well, the diagnosis process that we just described as being very expensive process, okay, of injecting dying, basically.
So, but pharmaceutical companies pay for that during the development of the drug. So while it may not be, you know, if you go to your regular physician to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, they're probably not going to do that. But in clinical trials, we do that a lot, because we want to make sure now that we're getting the right patients into the studies. So we're getting more sophisticated as we allow patients into trials, but would that benefit you if you saw your physician on an outpatient basis? Probably not, because even if we knew that you had Alzheimer's, it's not going to make a difference in the treatment. We don't have good treatments right now.
Exactly. So all you're doing is basically identifying a person with either the beginning of physical evidence of Alzheimer's or not, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We have a caller?
We do. Identify yourself, caller, and welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Helen, and I just was wondering, if I have a family member I would like to refer to one of the studies, how would I go about doing that?
To get them into a trial, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
Hi, Helen. Thank you for calling in. So we have a website. It's cnstrial.com, or our telephone number is 1-866-7-TRIALS, and they can call and talk to one of our staff members that can talk to them about the studies that we have that are available for individuals with Alzheimer's disease or other neurological or psychiatric conditions.
So do you know, Helen, someone of your family members or some loved one you think suffering from Alzheimer's or something, and you're kind of looking for any answer you can get? Is that what I'm reading into this?
My mother.
Right.
Yeah, it's my mother. So I was this, you know, sounds interesting, and I think maybe she can at least maybe get some help.
Has she been diagnosed? It's again, we're going back to diagnosis. Your mother, yes. I'm assuming, exhibits signs of Alzheimer's, some sort of dementia or loss or memory loss or whatever. But what I'm hearing is it may or may not really be Alzheimer's. It might be some other slightly different form of dementia, in which case she would be in a trial for something that
let me turn around and ask the question. How do you guys qualify people to to take part in a trial?
So normally what happens, and it's a very detailed or a very intensive process for an individual to actually get into a study.
Okay.
So we go through a consent process where we explain the entire study to them. And we were talking about the complexity of trials earlier.
Right.
The consent process itself takes about an hour because our consent forms explain every possible side effect, the fact that they're participating in a study. And then after that, we go through a number of lab tests. We do physical exams. We normally do an MRI to look for the plaques in the brain. So depending upon the type of study, there's lots of different procedures. But what we're trying to do is to make sure that we're getting exactly those patients that do have Alzheimer's into the studies. And a lot of patients don't qualify. I mean, we have studies where 90% of individuals may not qualify for that particular study because maybe they don't have those particular plaques in the brain, but they might qualify for a different study.
So last question, Helen, before I let you go. So how long has your mother been diagnosed with this?
6 months.
6 months, okay. And is that a typical period of time that I don't know when they finally say, hey, I think you've got early onset or early stage Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, people come to kind of the diagnosis at different stages of the illness. A lot of people want to deny it. And so the loved ones or the family may keep them at home and help them to compensate for things. They develop lists. And so you get some people that come in fairly late in the process of Alzheimer's and actually are having quite a bit of functional impairment. And you get others that come in because they've gotten lost while driving and couldn't remember where they were somewhere. And that's the first symptom that they have.
Right.
So it really does vary.
Well, thank you, Helen. Anything else you want to know? I empathize with you. My mother went through Parkinson's for many years, and it's a long road as a caregiver to go down. You have a long road ahead of you.
Helen, if I may, I have a question. What was your, like, what caused you to actually take your mother in, for example, to get diagnosed? Was she exhibiting symptoms before? Can you share a little bit of that personal?
Because I think a lot. What the point is? Only reason we're asking. A lot of people, I think, deny it and put it aside. And we're trying to hear.
I would like to know what was your coming to terms with this? Like before, what caused you to be concerned and then proceed to have her diagnosed?
Just a lot of forgetfulness, like severe forgetfulness, where you know I would say something in the morning and then an hour later. I'm having to repeat things constantly, and it seemed more than your average person who's elderly that you kind of forget things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was constantly having to remind, which caused me a lot of concern. But I wanted to ask you something, too. Like, most recently, she's had a lot of depression, and I'm having a hard time finding treatment for her for that. I actually so serious at one point that I was thinking of putting her, like maybe bringing her to a hospital or trying to get her treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the hospitals I checked into had, I don't know, the units didn't seem appropriate for her for even a short term, you know, duration of getting her on a medication in a safe environment. And I was going to ask Dr. Walling, is there any place he knows of where I might be able to get that type of treatment for her? I mean, do they have any connection with places like that for services?
Yeah, great question, because, you know, oftentimes depression does run hand in hand. And if you saw the Alzheimer's special that was done on HBO, you actually saw a gentleman who planned his own suicide because of his diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And I believe he eventually did commit suicide. So, I mean, we are affiliated with a psychiatric hospital. If somebody has depression associated with that, it's Ocean View Psychiatric. They can call us at CNS, and we can get them in touch with Ocean View and the staff there that can help out.
And are you here
process.
In Orange County, or where are you at?
So we're just over the border. We're in Long Beach,
Long Beach
right
okay.
across from the Long Beach Airport.
Okay.
So,
and we've had, Helen, we've had a couple of people, a couple of guests on the show, too, that, you know, where it was more behavioral health and, you know, dealing with sort of those depression elements. I just want to say that CNS actually, I believe, you guys diagnose, I think, doctor, right?
We do.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's that aspect of it on the diagnosis side. But relevant to the depression, you know, we talk about, and you mentioned a little bit about, oh, you know, sort of the what you would assume an elder person forgetting is acceptable.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the issue and the problem with societally is that we look at, you know, isolation, depression, forgetfulness as being, oh, that's just natural aging.
Right.
And yet there are situations where, you know, you have a more vibrant social environment and those things are not actually part of the aging experience. So I think part of it is also a re-education on our part, those who are basically witnessing this, to say, no, this is not necessarily an acceptable part of aging, and maybe seek assistance, whether it's behavioral modification or, you know, so increasing social environment. I know from with my parents, you know, as you get older, it's just the circle gets smaller and smaller on the social side, and if people are not very extroverted, they tend to basically self-isolate. And so that's part of something
about
that
on our last show
we've always assumed, oh, that's just part of normal aging, right, that you're going to end up alone in a room, but not necessarily. So I think that part of it is the medical component, for sure, with diagnosis, but then there's also this sort of behavioral aspect, too, that we don't really emphasize enough.
You're absolutely right, because people get in a comfort zone, and that zone gets smaller and smaller.
Right.
All right, thank you, Helen. We've got to cut you off. See, we've got some other people calling in here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you, Helen.
Best of luck in your journey here.
Thank you very much.
All right. Wow. You know, we get these kind of calls all the time. People don't know where to turn. They don't know what to do. That was me. My mother suddenly developed Parkinson's. I'm an only child. And all of a sudden, my dad's calling me up crying, saying, I can't handle this. I don't know what to do with this. And my mom is getting more and more depressed, and she's getting more and more isolated. She doesn't want anybody to see her. She's embarrassed. She's afraid of falling. And then that makes her weaker. And it was just like a vicious circle. Went on for years.
What's interesting is, in your case, for example, it was a shared thing that your father shared with you.
Yes.
In the case of some people.
Which didn't come easy for him. He's an old Midwestern guy.
Yeah. In case of a particular situation that I'm aware of, the husband who ended up passing was, in fact, covering for the wife.
Yeah.
And the family didn't have even any idea until the gentleman passed away, and then now they basically realize how far gone it is. But he had been covering for his wife.
Yeah. My dad kind of did that. He denied it forever. Oh, they're coming in again. Here, hang on.
Yeah, my name is Charles.
Hey, Charles. Nice to have you on
the
show.
Thank you for taking my call.
So what's your question, what would you like to know from these experts here today?
So I would like to know if my grandmother suffers from paranoid schizophrenia.
Oh.
And I'm trying to find a facility for her, and I'm wondering how long is a typical stay? How long does somebody typically stay at a psychiatric facility such as the one you're talking about?
Doctor, I'm sorry. Yeah. Before Charles, if I may, could you share some of the indicators that give you that, like that concern, things that you're dealing with, just to give people a sense of.
And how long ago was she diagnosed with this?
Oh, she was diagnosed probably 10 years ago.
All right.
And she hears voices. She thinks people are after her. She believes that, you know, there's government conspiracies.
Yeah, they're listening in on her and all that stuff. And
yeah,
typical
very,
kind of
very
stuff we heard.
Paranoid.
Right. And so 10 years, how have you dealt with it for 10 years? Does she live with you? Does she live alone? Does she live with somebody else?
Well, she's my wife and I are caring for her, and we're doing the best we can. But sometimes when she stops, you know, she refuses to take her medication or something like that. And
or hides really, it or doesn't take it or whatever.
She hides it, and we just have a hard time controlling her. And so I wonder if there's a place that we can take her. It's nice, you know. We've toured a couple facilities, and they seemed really, you know. I don't want to put my grandmother there.
Where are you located, Charles?
I'm in Huntington Beach.
Okay. And last question, we'll bring this up too. How do you pay for all this stuff? Because this has got to be really expensive. Is this something that Medicare or Medicaid would pay for?
Well, luckily, we have financing available through our family, and yes, she is on Medicare, but. That's really not the biggest issue. It's
okay, good. Congratulations.
Because no, we're okay financially, and thank goodness, my grandfather, you know, did well in life, and so.
Charles, has you know, having the fact that you've been dealing with this for 10 years, just again for the benefit of the listeners, has this changed over 10 years? Has it been consistent? Has it deteriorated? Has it been intensified?
Yeah, it's probably at its most most intense stage right now. It's gradually gotten worse. For about 3 or 4 years, we had it. You know, it was manageable, and she seemed to be living a pretty "quote unquote" normal life.
Yeah.
And but probably the last 3 years, it's gotten worse, and her short-term memory has deteriorated. It's really depressing, and we're struggling to find avenues that can.
How old is she?
She's 78.
Wow.
So this is, we were talking earlier about diagnosis, and this is where being a good diagnostician comes into play. It would be very rare for somebody to develop schizophrenia at 68 years of age. So she's only had it for 10 years. To me, that there is certainly late life psychosis, mm-hmm. but it makes me wonder if maybe something else is going on and causing it.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously want a scan of the brain to make sure that not something else is not going on. It could be a tumor or something like that that's causing it. I'd also want to look to see, is it potentially late life depression with psychotic features, because that would be more common than schizophrenia in somebody that's that age.
So the importance of diagnosis, again.
Back to the importance of diagnosis, right?
Getting a good diagnosis. Again, it's not that I haven't seen cases of late life schizophrenia, but your average, for a woman, the average time that they're going to develop schizophrenia is between 17 and 29 years of age.
That's what I heard, around 30. Yeah.
So for 30, somebody to develop it at 68, there's potentially something.
There's an unusualness to it.
So
where does Charles go to get assistance or possibly reevaluation?
Ocean View Psychiatric is the facility that we're affiliated with. We are a private psychiatric hospital. Every room is a private room. So one of the reasons we built it that way is because we do have a lot of senior clients, and we wanted them to have privacy that they wouldn't get in other psychiatric hospitals. If you go to most psychiatric hospitals, there's 3 or 4 patients to a room.
Right.
I'm biased, but I think we have the best doctors and the best nurses. What I would recommend is an evaluation to check out to see if something.
And where would they get that done? Obviously, I'm assuming where do you take her to? Your normal physician or a specialist?
You'd want to see a psychiatrist, and hopefully a geriatric psychiatrist for somebody that age. Because the other thing that you have to keep in mind is, as we get older, medications are processed through the body differently.
Right.
So they tend to stay in the body longer. We have what we call half-lives for medication, and as we get older, those half-lives, the amount of time it takes for the body to clear half of the medication, gets longer and longer.
Well, and don't you usually also at that point also need to evaluate things like nutritional behavior patterns and other eating
Absolutely.
Habits and so forth.
Yeah.
Charles, let me ask you, where was the diagnosis 10 years ago, if you mind? Was it a general practitioner? Was it a specialist?
I think it was a general practitioner. And I should preface this whole thing that she did have a history. We've just learned this. A history of sexual abuse as a child. So I'm sure
that affected some of the
additional factors that contributed to this as well.
Which again, those are things, to the doctor's point here, Dr. Walling's point, is that this is, if you're dealing with a specialist, then those things are maybe things that are considered, but a general practitioner may not be looking beyond certain.
Right.
So what I'm hearing is maybe get her reevaluated before you put her in a facility and make sure you're dealing with the correct diagnosis.
So would they be able to receive that maybe more accurate evaluation or a second opinion, if you will, at that facility?
Absolutely. I mean, if they give us a call, we'll work with them to try.
So while we got Charles on the line, how does he get hold of you guys?
So I have the number for the CNS portion of things.
No, this is kind of embarrassing. Dr. Wall, he's not supposed to forget, but he's forgetting his own phone.
No, he's got his number.
So the number for Ocean View Psychiatric is 844-562-1212.
He's so deep in these trials, he doesn't deal with the phone. He never answers.
Charles, it's actually in the address, if this is correct,
yes.
It's on Redondo Avenue in Long Beach. And the number to CNS, doctor, if you wouldn't mind.
Is 1-866-7-TRIALS, T-R-I-A-L-S.
Okay. I happen to...
I was just going to say,
computer, and I have the web page pulled up right now, and so thank you very much.
Any trials for schizophrenia and those kinds of things?
So schizophrenia is actually my love. So I started as a schizophrenia researcher 25 years ago when I was teaching medical school at the University of Texas Medical Branch down in Galveston, and worked on all of the antipsychotics that have come to market since the early 90s, and continue to do a lot of psychiatric research in schizophrenia. We have neurologists and other psychiatrists that specialize in different areas, but schizophrenia is really my area of expertise.
Well, it's fascinating that you kind of discussed it from the angle that you came at it from the angle that you know, relevant to Charles' situation, because we talked about it last week. You know, even in case of recovery or drug abuse, you know, or detox, is that for the longest time the approach has been the drug and not the triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it depends, you know, how you pose that question predetermines the answers you're going to get. So if you're dealing with somebody who's going to look beyond, like to Charles' point, you know, that there's a history of sexual abuse or
right.
a history of some sort of, you know, unusual occurrence that has happened, that factors in. And that could, I mean, if this woman has been on medication for the last 10 years and there's been more to this than just what it seems, I think, Charles, you know, I would definitely love to hear back from you and call the show if you do go down the path of getting a re-diagnosis
or
another opinion. What that they say, maybe a reaffirmation of the condition, or maybe there's a new insight that comes out of it. If you don't mind, if you feel comfortable, I'd love to have you call in and share that with us.
Yeah, please.
And I will say,
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
We got to cut him off because we got some other people.
Charles, thank you so much for calling. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
All right.
Thank you.
Wow. So what I'm hearing loud and clear is make sure you got the right diagnosis, because you might be doing the wrong treatment.
Well, and the other thing I will say, you know, having practiced in Texas, we were the hospital for all of Southeast Texas, so people would actually drive 6 miles to see us. And it was not uncommon for families to bring somebody in that was older, that they had kept at home and maintained, but that had had symptoms for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. So those types of things do happen. I mean, it's possible that in Charles' case, you know, maybe his grandmother had some odd behavior. Maybe she had heard voices earlier and had not
talked to people
about them. So that certainly does come into play as well. It's, again, a good diagnostic interview is really what's
well, and I think the thing that we also sometimes forget is that there's generational approaches, right? Like in past generations, it may be more common to just kind of keep it hidden and keep it quiet, and you know, it has an impact on the family, especially in close knit neighborhoods and communities. So it's interesting that, you know, I think it is very important that you're going to the right person for evaluation. The cost factor is always an issue, but at least the peace of mind of knowing,
yes.
You know, what price do you really put on that, at least?
And what, just before we jump ahead, because Charles said they were fortunate, money wasn't an issue. For most of us, money was an issue. We looked at places for my mother, and it was double whammy. It was horrible. My dad would never put her there. I'd feel guilty putting her there. She didn't want to go there. And it was a ton of money.
Yeah.
$6,000-$7,000 a month.
Well, and I'm reading from the flyer for Ocean View, just to kind of answer that question. So they do accept private insurance as well as Medicare and HMOs, Medicare HMOs.
Yep.
So, to me, some of the stuff that's going on right now, as far as, you know, flushing out the new approach to health coverage and so forth, is equally worrisome. Because
it scares the hell
because
out of me,
we
yeah.
are already dealing with an overly expensive thing to deal with, and then not having enough coverage to take care of that,
right.
especially, you know, if you're dealing with somebody like Charles' mom, that's a pre-existing condition that's been on the books for 10 years.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a lot of other things involved here that, you know, I'm glad that we're having this discussion today. I do want to go to the next caller. I think we should probably take a... Do we want to take a break?
Let's do the call, and then we'll do a break.
Okay. So
all right,
caller.
So welcome to the show, and identify yourself, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, so my name is Matt. I was just actually calling regarding my brother.
Okay.
He was diagnosed about 2 years ago with schizophrenia.
Yeah.
He had talked earlier. He looked online about some kind of trials, and he was thinking about it. And so, obviously,
And who diagnosed it? Was it a physician, a psychiatrist? Who diagnosed it?
Yeah, it was a psychiatrist.
Okay.
It was kind of an outbreak, and then he was diagnosed after seeing a psychiatrist. But yeah, so I had a quick question about the trials. So once someone does call in that number, how long, or what's the process for getting into a study? Are there certain qualifications? And then he had also asked me about like compensation for that. Are patients compensated for it? Or
it's a good question.
Insurance?
And how many? How many trials and how many people? Is this exactly one in a million, or is this one a week? You know, I don't know.
So it depends on the area of research.
The drug, problem.
With schizophrenia, we actually do a lot of schizophrenia trials because, again, that's
it's your love.
That's my area.
I hope you don't say that at parties. I love schizophrenia.
I actually do.
You don't go to many parties then, do you?
No, they keep me locked up.
Exactly.
So it depends. With schizophrenia, there's lots of different studies, lots of different medications that are in development, everything from new antipsychotics, so drugs to treat the voices. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you know, some of our older medications have a lot of side effects and some pretty nasty side effects. So looking at medications that maybe control the medication, the voices and the hallucinations or the delusions the same way but have fewer side effects associated with
them. What kind of ugly side effects have we seen from some of these drugs? They're pretty powerful drugs, I know that.
So they are. And so if you talked about your mother having Parkinson's,
right.
Well, we see Parkinsonian symptoms in some patients on the older drugs. If you talk about Haldol or Thorazine, you see patients that have difficulty walking,
shake,
a slowed gait.
Yeah.
They have what we call bradykinesia, which is slowed movements. They do shake. They develop what we call tardive dyskinesia, which can be facial muscles that move in ways that are uncontrollable, even other parts of their body. Their wrists or their arms. So those were our older medications, although some of those are still in use. Then we developed what we call the atypical or second-generation antipsychotics, such as olanzapine or Seroquel, but those have side effects as well, such as weight gain and metabolic problems, and we tend to see more diabetes in patients that have that take those medications.
Come in for one problem, you get a new one.
Exactly. So we're always looking, and the pharmaceutical companies are always looking at medications that have fewer and fewer side effects.
So in schizophrenia, let's just give me some ballpark numbers here. His brother wants to get into a trial. What are the odds of doing that? First, he has to find a trial. And how many of those are happening? And then how many people are typically in a trial? 100, 1,000, 10? I don't know.
So again, it depends on the study. If it's an early phase study, so where we're just testing the safety of the drug in humans, it may only be 30 people that would be in the study.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a study for FDA approval, which is what we would call a phase 3 study, those involve hundreds of patients, sometimes thousands. So it depends on the type of study, and then it depends on what he's looking for. Is he looking for a medication that may help control the voices, because that's different than a drug that's looking to improve cognition in schizophrenia. So we have specific trials that are looking to improve an individual's thought processes.
So let's ask him, Matt. What is your brother you think looking for?
It's mainly for the voices. He just is like certain meds that he's on now just like don't seem to be working, and so he was just kind of looking at different meds out there.
What meds is he on?
He was on Seroquel recently and Zyprexa.
So anything that you guys are dealing with right now that his brother may be...
Are those older drugs or newer drugs?
So those are what we call the second-generation antipsychotics, atypical antipsychotics. So they're the ones that have the fewer side effects. But Zyprexa is one that has been linked to diabetes. Seroquel has also had weight gain associated with it. So there's certainly things that we're hoping to have medications that don't cause those same side effects.
And I'm still struggling. Maybe you can't put a number on this. I know because we're trying to pin you down here. What's his chance of his brother getting into this stuff? Good, bad, remote?
So pretty good, I would say. It depends. So it sounds like, Matt, how old is your brother?
He's 28.
So he's young. So chances are he's healthy. So his laboratory results are probably not going to rule things out.
Okay.
Then the next question is drugs and alcohol, because we do rule out people who have significant drug and alcohol histories.
And I'll bet that runs hand-in-hand with schizophrenia.
Oftentimes it does.
I got to do something to get rid of the voice. I'll self-medicate here.
Absolutely. Up to 50% of patients with schizophrenia do use drugs to self-medicate. And depending upon the study you look at, it can be up to 80%.
And you exclude those because those would just corrupt the trial, right?
Exactly.
Skew the result. Right.
Yeah, you don't want drugs causing a person's voices to get worse during the study. You want to make sure that you're actually treating.
Okay, so they're young. You got to be in good health. That's a concern. You've got liabilities. You don't want to have somebody die during the trial or get sick or whatever. You've got to have somebody that is a good test for a good match for this specific drug.
Yep.
What other things would rule them out?
Well, how would they go about? How would his brother go about basically initiating contact with you guys?
Yeah, if he's in Orange County, he can give us a call at the 8667 trials number and talk to one of our staff members, and they're happy to discuss.
They'll go through all this.
Matt, do you have access to the website? Have you looked at the CNS website?
I haven't looked at it yet, but
okay,
I will.
Let's give him the website.
Yeah, so the website is cnstrial.com.
Okay. CNSTrial.com.
All right. Well, best of luck with your brother's condition. Again, I feel for everybody calling in here today, and I know how difficult it is to make these phone calls and to try and come to grips with these situations and deal with them.
Well, I also will extend to you the same invitation I extended to the previous caller, Matt. If you feel up to it and would like to share after you go down this path, whatever the result is, whether your brother gets accepted into this program or not,
yeah,
you know, to call back the show and let us know what's
going
on.
Give us your real life experience.
We really firmly believe in that personal experience sharing, because I think
Absolutely.
A lot of people just don't have a clarity. I mean, the gentleman that was on before, you know, where they're diagnosed by a general practitioner 10 years ago, and there may be some other things, and I think people don't think that. And the more we talk about these things openly and sort of vulnerably, I think we benefit other people that may be listening.
Does your brother live with you or by himself?
He lives with our family.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a hard one. We've done other shows in the past with people with schizophrenia and trying to deal with it. We had another show that was called The Grief Girl, and she deals with families that are dealing with grief that comes with this. Just the feeling of, oh, my God, I can't solve this, and I can't help it, and
well,
I
you
feel
can hear
terrible.
It, you can hear it in Matt's voice. I mean, it's not just the person that's dealing with the actual issue.
Very
it's
traumatic.
It's the family around them, too. So best of luck, Matt. I really appreciate
you God be
you
with
calling.
You. Best
Thank
of luck.
So
and
much.
Stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Anybody else has any phone calls? We've only got a few minutes left. That phone number again is 949-330-7761. We've had an outpouring of phone calls. I'm sorry, we're really not capable to take that many, but we have another one coming in right now here. So I'll let you guys talk and I'll answer it here.
So that's amazing. So, and how long have you got? I mean, you guys may have touched on this with CNS. How long has CNS been around?
So, excuse me, we've been a company for 17 years now.
Yeah.
I first started doing trials again in 92 when I was with the University of Texas Medical Branch. But over the years, there was kind of a move away from academic sites doing studies and moving it to private sites mm-hmm. because the academic sites were taking a long time to get enrolling, and there wasn't a lot of incentive at a university for people to do that because you're working on your other research. So we opened CNS 17 years ago and have grown from a company of 3 people to 180 individuals.
Wow.
And 4 offices.
And your offices, you know, you mentioned Long Beach. Where else do you have offices?
So we have an office in Garden Grove, which is an outpatient psychiatric office. We have an office in Torrance, and then we also have one in the Oakland area, in Northern California.
Northern California, too.
Yep.
Wow, that's amazing. We have another caller.
Oh. Yeah, identify yourself, caller, and welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Kathy.
Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
What would you like to ask them?
Yes, I also have a family member that has been in and out of psych facilities for about the last 15 years. And I was wondering, what is the process once they get into the hospital? Is there psychiatrists that can treat them there and treat them once they leave the hospital as well? Do you help set up
outpatient care and follow-up care?
Continuity care.
And let's get more specific. So what were they in there for, and why did they let them out?
Well, it's been ongoing for about 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
And they get in there. They do well. They take their meds.
For what? For what diagnosis?
Major depression.
Major depression. Okay. And they get in there for a while and feels better, and they feel like it's time to get back into society, and something happens, they slip back again.
Right. And then they slip back, and we have no resources available to us. It's usually a very short stay, and we get home and we've lost our resources, and they kind of go back into being non-med compliant.
And when you say resources, you're talking about the wherever facility you put them, they say this is all we can do. They've plateaued or gotten better, and we're going to release them back to you, and you don't hear from them again or don't know
right,
where to go next.
Exactly. So there's never any good follow-up, and there's never any good, aftercare plans that we can really, hang on to. And
fix it and get them out.
How old are they, Kathy?
She's 37.
37, wow. All right, so, doctor, what do you say to somebody who's in and out with these conditions?
Yeah, this is kind of a really difficult issue in psychiatry, because we can't force patients to take medications.
Yeah.
Individuals have rights, and whether or not they take their medications, that's certainly their right. But there's also a stigma that goes along with taking medication, too. So a lot of people don't want to take medication daily, and so, it reminds them that they're mentally ill. If the individual had schizophrenia, we have what we call long-acting injectable medications now, where we can give a medication, and it can stay in the body for up to 3 months.
Wow.
So essentially, they only have to get a shot once every 3 months, and that maintains their symptoms. However, when it comes to depression, we don't have the same types of medications. So, a lot of times it's working with the patient and discussing the importance and developing that aftercare plan. I think one of the things that we really pride ourselves on at our hospital at Ocean View Psychiatric is making sure that patients have that aftercare plan. We have doctors that are available to see them after the end, which is something a lot of hospitals don't have, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure why. But if you try to call and get an appointment with a psychiatrist these days, oftentimes it's 6 or 8 weeks to be able to get in to see them. Well, a patient that comes into the hospital in an acute state and stays for 7 days or so, and we get them stabilized, if we send them out and say, well, go see your doctor now, it may be a long time before they can actually see that doctor.
And am I wrong? Because I'll confess again, I've had a couple episodes in my life of major depression in my own life. It runs in my mother's side of the family. And so you kind of think, well, I'm just going to buck up and get past it,
yeah.
Right?
Well, that's what I was
going to
ask.
And then you go on a drug for a while, and it helps you get to a point. That's why I took Paxil and some of those other things. It kind of brings you back to where you're more resilient. But some of it, there are underlying causes you got to address, too. It might be just family history, your life's going on, other sort of. Some of it's chemical, some of it's
behavioral.
Yeah. Right.
Well, Kathy, when that person was in getting care, was that part of the regimen and the program that they got a benefit from? Was there that behavioral sort of counseling?
Was it all drug component? Or just behavioral as well? Counseling and therapy?
Well, it's usually just been drugs. The hospital that we have sent her to in the past, they claim that they have some behavioral mod and that they have groups and resources available to them and psychotherapy, but really, it's like herding cattle in these places, and there's just not much substance to it. And so they get out, and there's nothing to follow up with.
Because I think that's...
Sometimes it's even worse than when they came in, because
yeah.
Now there's been a little glimmer of hope, but now they're thrown into the deep end of the pool.
In my own case, I can only tell you that I tried to deal with it myself and wasn't getting where. I went to see a psychiatrist, and they said, well, we can put you on. I was like, I don't want to take a drug. I don't want to get drugged out and everything here. And I'm tougher than that. I can face this. I can deal with it. But the drug helped me deal with it. The drug didn't make it go away. The drug allowed me to be more resilient and not to go into deep depression or whatever. It allowed me to sort of get back to a point where I could, through a couple years of therapy, kind of address some of the symptoms, where this is coming from and why I do this, and to recognize the symptoms. So if I start to go in that direction again, I stop myself.
Well, but that heightened awareness isn't going to come from prescription drugs.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's not going to come over a short stay.
The drug doesn't
somewhere.
Solve it, but the drug gave me the ability to deal with it.
So what,
but I still had to find ways to deal with it.
So what can somebody like Kathy do, doctor?
So certainly seeing a psychiatrist and having regular appointments, I think, again, if hospitalization is needed, we're available for that. But the other thing that when we look at something like depression, I mean, you're right, there's behavior modification. in addition to medication, and I think oftentimes medication is the base to allow a patient to get better. If we look at it like a pyramid, medication serves as the base, but then oftentimes what we want to do is add on to that, like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been shown over and over again to be effective for depression. And it, back in the 90s, we did a study where we looked at medication Serizone along with cognitive behavior therapy, and the two together actually work so much better than either one alone.
Yeah.
And then, you know, other things, I love to run. Well, exercise, there's lots of literature nowadays talking about the
phenomenal.
The
I got into running, too, as part of it, just to be outside and to do that. Tremendous, tremendous. Changing my diet helped. I was eating too much crap and sugar and other stuff, and that made me feel better. You know, all stuff that I thought, this is stupid. This isn't good or anything. The combination of all those things, this has been 10 years ago that this happened.
That's kind of interesting. I think we're in a society, and I'm not taking away from the immediacy of needing to have that relief, both for that person and the family or the people around them, which medication provides. But I think we also don't really embrace. We know, it's like, you know, it's funny. We know that we should, but we don't.
Right.
Embrace a more holistic approach to dealing with these things, whether it be a depression, whether it be even just diabetes or health. I mean, there's so many other components. We just want to take a pill and call it a day, and that's going to fix it.
Right.
Well, pills have side effects.
And particularly when you say depression, just because I've been through it. I think depression... I needed a pill to start the process, but I needed to work with a psychiatrist over a long period of time to identify the symptoms, the triggers, and to modify my behavior. It wasn't all just think about it in my childhood and come up with some answer why I'm doing this. It also was changing certain things about getting more exercise, changing my diet. The cumulative that, and the theory was that I have some genetic predisposition to this. My mother had it. My grandmother had it. So, therefore, I have to recognize the symptoms and avoid the triggers and the behavior and the foods and things that cause
it. Kathy, where are you located?
I'm located in Seal Beach.
In Seal Beach.
Have you ever tried long-term psychiatric, all these kind of therapies and stuff? It sounds like you put her in for a walk because she gets really, really bad, and then they sort of bring her up a little bit, and then that there's no follow-up care.
Right, exactly. And then she leaves, and she stays on the medication for a while, and then... She starts to taper herself off, thinking she doesn't need it.
Yeah,
she
right.
feels better. And
I'm really going to encourage you not to just view drugs as the end, but the start.
Yeah, and,
right.
and
that's what I was hoping, to find a place that could continue to work with us on the outside.
Yeah, and
Kathy, not to take away from, I mean, obviously, when somebody gets hospitalized for depression, it's more than just depression.
Yeah.
So there's something, you know, oftentimes the people are at kind of the lowest point in their life, and they need that hospitalization.
Right. Well, for safety factor.
You need an
intervention
and just to get you up and started again. Right?
Yeah. So you know, again, that's something that certainly Ocean View can provide, but also, you know, we will make sure that you're connected with services, that your loved one has those services, because it's too easy to fall through the cracks, particularly when you're looking at depression.
Would you like that address and telephone number for Ocean View, Kathy?
Absolutely. I'd appreciate it.
Okay. So the location is in Long Beach. It's 2600 Redondo Avenue in Long Beach, California, and the telephone number is 844-562-1212, and their website is ovphf.com, ovphf.com. And Doctor, if you wouldn't mind just giving her also the CNS number.
Sure. The CNS number is 1-866-7-TRIALS, T-R-I-A-L-S, or the website cnstrial.com.
Okay.
Come up with a long-term plan. It isn't a quick fix.
In many cases, especially if you have a predisposition,
yes.
This is a lifetime awareness that, you know, once you get into a regimen that is actually working for you and hopefully have a consciousness that it's working for you, then you make it part of that daily
life. My doctor finally told me, he said, think of it as alcoholism. You have a predisposition. I don't have that case, but it's kind of like that. It's a gene. It's a whatever it is, you're predisposed to it genetically or whatever. You're going to have to be aware of it and realize, you know, so I say I'm a depressive, like some people say they're an alcoholic.
This happens to be what you're suffering from.
Yeah, and I haven't, believe me, I've been depressed free for 10, 15 years, but there are always moments I start to feel, oh, this is starting again or whatever here, and I got to stop it, or I got to get out and exercise. I got to look at what I'm doing. I got to slow down, and you know, whatever steps I use to deal with this that developed over a long period of time. So I would hesitate to look at drugs as the answer.
It's the ultimate sustainable.
Right.
Yeah. Kathy, again, if you would like, please feel free to call us back and let us know how that turns out
and what
your experience is.
Thank you.
All right. Hope it helps.
Have a great day.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to see, either wrap this up or maybe we'll roll it out longer. We're getting so many phone calls here. We'll see what the doctors can stay or not. But stick around. This is you're listening to The Rad Life.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge, with the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days, all with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right. Well, we're giving out tons of information here today. This has been very therapeutic and very informative. And but we're staying a little longer. She's eating a Nutri-Grain bar to hang her out here.
Carla's eating Nutri-Grain. Did we bring enough for everybody?
We can hear this crackling.
We did bring
sound.
Enough for everybody.
We got a whole box of
them
right there.
Wait. You're squirreling into Paul's stash.
That's right. Go ahead.
Here you go.
Let's start.
Well, you know, once you're done with the Nutri-Grain bar, not that we ended on that note, but there's a whole bunch of single malts, I think, on
yeah.
the side.
Yeah. That's the other way. We got another way to medicate here today.
Yeah. For those people who are watching us on YouTube, you usually see this side of the studio, which is really pristine and clean and
perfect.
It's just a orange wall and a couple minor things.
Where we take
it's very minimalist on this side, right? But on that side,
oh, you never going to
okay,
see that side.
It's like a friggin' pantry from Costco. Right? if the bomb dropped, Paul would be okay. I want to make sure everybody knows.
You're actually right. There are single malts.
Oh,
there
yes.
Are.
Yeah.
I'm Irish.
You should come
I'm
back
Irish.
For our Christmas show. He's got a crackling fire on YouTube going on, and we're about like this wee bit away from singing carols in here. Usually.
I think so. Yeah. So we normally, as you know, the show ends at round one here, and we have some pre-recorded shows we run. I'm going to push one of those back and offer the opportunity if more people have phone calls. We'll take them till 1:30 here. So the phone number again is 949-330-7761. That's 949-330-7761. I suspect our audience has already left because they're used to the show ending at 1, but if there is anybody still listening live for this show, we're still willing to take some
calls. I've got a bit of just business we usually take care of during the break. I just want to tell everybody one of our guests, former guests, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ivor Roth, who I've known for a couple of years. He's been in the process of opening his concierge podiatry practice on Old Newport Road, I think. It's John, like, where the end of the 55 across from Hogue.
The Old Newport Road. Yes. It runs kind of parallel to it.
The end of Hogue. And finally, he's been trying to do this for a couple of years and hit a bunch of snags, just opening this facility that's a little bit more of a holistic approach. He does practice out of a medical building right across from Hogue, but this is a new location. So I just wanted to share with everybody that, and I'm going to do a little live feed probably later on today from there on my Facebook page. March 15th, 5 to 8, Concierge Podiatry and Spa in Newport Beach. It's you're cordially invited. You tell them I sent you. And, you know, when everybody shows up and there's not enough room, then you tell them, I sent you.
So that's right. Anyway, they're front of the line here.
You get a complimentary mini spa service. I just had a pedicure over there. And
that's why you were late. Don't tell us
not
this other
today,
stuff.
Not today. Not today. I do my pedicures at night. Okay, because then I, you know, they're glowing for the next day. But no. But they
that's too much information.
You're the one with the red underwear today. Okay, so don't give me that. Right? But I just want to give the address. It's 495 Old Newport Boulevard, Suite 300, Newport Beach. And you can RSVP on their website, which is newportbeachnails.com, or call 949-335-5318. This gentleman has been in practice for many, many years. There's a lot of corrective foot treatments, and this is just one more thing that they have done. Their facility is wonderful. It's beautiful. It's up on the top roof.
And you know what I learned out of it? Because I've never had a pedicure. Come on, I'm from the Midwest.
Well, and then fungus. I mean, we talk pedicures, but it's
I learned
fungus
about fungus and how much that can wreck your feet. And I really learned what I've always kind of known is if your feet start to fail, the rest of your spine and your hips and your legs and all the other stuff is going to follow here. It's the foundation.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And summer's coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked him again when I was over there the other day. I said, you know, what about flip-flops? He goes, I hate them. There's no cushion. There's nothing. But you know what? I'm from San Clemente. If somebody doesn't own a pair of rainbows, you get kicked out of town, right? So they are a very, very much an ultimate destination for nail and foot care. And I have invited you now all for the 15th. So
and I think
I'll hope to see you guys there.
Fall
5 to 8.
Into the category of some of the other stuff you brought in here. This warm fuzzy stuff. He got me a massage one time in here, and now he always talks about pedicures.
He got massaged in the chair.
In the chair.
Okay,
right
hold on. Hold on. Don't be playing tough guy with me now, right? He got massaged in the chair, and I think your words were before they came in here was and the topic was wellness. That wellness is different for everybody, right?
Right.
And that massage is looked at as a pampering treat, but in fact, it really should be an adjustment and an alignment thing, and it's something that you give to yourself. I mean, you have the lymph drainage and all a bunch of different stuff that happens out of it as a result of it. So a lot more and more people are actually incorporating it into their wellness regimen, right? Well, Paul started off by telling me he's never had a massage.
I've never had a massage.
The Midwest tough guy, they never had a massage. They came in, and all of a sudden, Paul has had a massage before, but a long time ago.
I was denying it. I didn't want to admit it.
And then as the barriers and the walls came down, okay.
It was heavenly.
Paul was sitting there going, yes, can you go deeper?
Oh.
Okay, so
which goes to my point, and then will lead to your cohort's comment.
But this is all care.
I know.
I mean, we talk about all of this stuff as being care. Some of it may be lighthearted, but some of it's really serious. And the bottom line is to talk about it. Because
when
we don't talk about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So why do we deny it? I'm not going to go get a pedicure. I'm not going to get a massage. And I don't need therapy and psychiatry. I'm a tough guy. Shake it off. Suck it up. Hide it off.
You probably would have shared the fact that you had a bout of depression before you shared that you had a massage. What's that all about? Oh, he's getting all panicky over there, dropping all kinds of stuff on his board.
So, yes. I just want to end with that. Why is it?
Why would you admit to depression, but then you have a difficulty talking about massage?
Well, because I don't know. Because I finally came to grips with depression. Massage is still one of those things, touchy-feely stuff that I don't want to do.
Am I the only one sitting in the room? Have you had a massage?
I have, but yeah.
Not many, okay. All right, your friend, your cohort here, identify yourself. You had some comments.
Have you had a massage?
Yes.
Would you admit to having massaged?
Yes.
See? This side of the room has no problem admitting to having massaged.
Identify yourself, and then I just wanted you to share what we were talking about offline.
Yeah. So I'm Jack Stevens. I founded the company with Dr. Walling, and I'm just here for support, but I had a comment during the break that, you know, we will oftentimes see people who don't take medication that, I mean, clearly there are medications out there that will help them for a mental health condition. And, you know, people, there's a lot of denial of illness.
Saying,
and,
right?
You know, I'll say to people that say, well, I don't want to take Paxil or I don't want to take an antidepressant. You know, I'll say when you have a headache, you'll take Tylenol. You don't just, you know, bear with it and, you know, say, I'm just going to live with the pain because I don't want to take something for it. You know, there are acceptable, you'll use soap.
Why are you looking at me when he says that?
We're hoping, but
and especially before you get a massage.
You know, unfortunately, in our society, there's a real stigma, and then what we get is, you know, you get people that have schizophrenia that won't take their medications, and you say, well, what's really at the bottom of it? Is it the side effects? Is it what is it? Well, the main reason is that it's even with the symptoms as severe as they are, it's denial of illness. They say the voices actually come from God or the devil or my, you know, relative that passed, and they don't want to accept that it's schizophrenia,
or
and therefore they don't need the meds.
Or the family's in denial.
Right.
Well, when
we talk
about denial all the time as a society, it's to the point where it's almost a cliche, but it's a very genuine thing.
I mean, real
and very powerfully negatively impacting people's life.
And I'll add, I don't know if people have seen, but Alzheimer's is the third, fourth, fifth leading cause of death now.
Yeah,
so heart attack, cancer, and then Alzheimer's. So, but I think one of the reasons we don't get more people calling in that want to participate in research is I think that there's a lot of denial. People don't want to admit that the changes that are happening are real. They think it's just age related.
Stigma and denial.
So I
denied going to the value of seeing a podiatrist, I denied going to a psychiatrist, I denied all these things until you really are forced to deal with them either with yourself or somebody else. And then you say, why am I doing this?
But that's just because you got a couple of strikes against you. One, you're a guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Two, I'm from the Midwest.
Two, you're from the Midwest. Right, exactly.
I'm Irish.
But it's also generational, right? The guy's, I'm going to bite on a piece of wood and put a metal. What are we going to do to cure this?
Well, you told your friend the podiatrist story that you had a friend that was very athletic and had some foot problem, and he just kept.
He almost died, and it was such a small world that actual Dr. Roth was the guy that basically worked on him.
He put it off so long, it got infected, it got a problem, and it could have killed him. What should have been something he just should have dealt with quickly and easily turned into a major disease.
Yeah, my neighbor across the street
almost had to cut his foot off. Yeah.
So let's talk about that for a second. I mean, you guys are running all these clinical trials, and Jack, you were saying that you don't get a lot of calls for some certain reasons because people are dealing with this sort of stigma or denial factor. So let me ask you, with all the trials that you're going, how do you get the word out? How do you get people
newspaper
basically
ads,
wanting to be part of
right,
what is effective way of getting that message out?
So I think it depends on the illness, quite honestly. So with schizophrenia, we're very well known, and we have a lot of patients and families that call us.
Because you love schizophrenia, I heard.
I do.
You'll never live that
one. You know, what I will say is, with schizophrenia, it's been so gratifying over the years to see some of the newer medications and see patients actually regaining their lives.
I'll bet, yeah.
So I mean, that's why I love working with that population, those individuals that have a chance to recover things that they didn't have before.
And we got another caller here. Let's get them back on here.
Okay.
All right. Let's do that. Welcome, caller, and identify yourself and welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi. My name is Mike.
Hi, Mike. And, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I know you guys have been kind of talking more about studies, but I kind of had a question more about, like, the facility, Ocean View.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, like, I have a sister, and she's had schizophrenia for, like, probably, like, 7 years now. And she's been in and out of a lot of other, like, hospitals in the area. And so I was just kind of wondering, we haven't had very good experience at a lot of these hospitals. So, like, what kind of does Ocean View offer?
Why are you guys any better than all the other lousy
Before you guys answer that, let me ask you something, Mike. What were some of those experiences that you had?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just having, like, multiple, like, patients in one room, having to be, like, on lockdown, for a good part of the day. They were very dirty, kind of like they would smell, like they'd be very, you know, like just kind of not very kept up very well.
Mm-hmm. So they're just locking them up all day for you somewhere here.
And like, how did you pay for that? Was it? I mean,
it was through insurance, like Medicare.
Medicare, okay.
Okay. And how old is this person?
She's 27.
She's 27.
Okay, so we're not dealing with a 90-year-old doddering lady or something here. So you put her. How many facilities have you been to, roughly?
Like four different ones.
Four different ones. These are all somewhere in Southern California, and none of them you liked. You all felt locked up, dirty, ignored, packed, crowded. Not good care.
Yeah, exactly.
And last, just, I mean, I know you were asking specifically about Ocean View, but just to give us people a sense of where you're at, where are you located?
What city are you in here?
We're in Bellflower.
You're in Bellflower.
Okay. All right. So you're here. So, all right. So this has been their experience?
Yeah.
So you hear this before?
Why Ocean
View?
Yeah.
So I've spent the last 30 years working in psychiatric hospitals, and I've seen lots of different types of hospitals that are out there. And so when we took on building Ocean View, we actually wanted it to be different. Most of the hospitals that are out there are 3 to 4 patients to a room. Most of them have very prescribed, you know, the caller mentioned, you know, being locked down and things like that. We're a voluntary facility. All of our rooms are private rooms, so it's no sharing of rooms. We have flat screen TVs in every room. Everything is designed with patient safety in mind. So if you look at our curtains, they're breakaway curtains. There's special ways that we have blinds so that the staff can view the patient in the room. We do 15-minute checks on patients. So we try to keep their safety first and foremost, but at the same time, we try to make it the most comfortable environment possible.
So let me ask you the hard question. So is this unaffordable to the average person? Is this just the Cadillac facility for the few that can afford it?
It's interesting because some of the reviewers for different agencies that come in to review us, they call us the Beverly Hills of psychiatric hospitals.
Right.
However, I mean, we take all insurance. We have contracts with pretty much every insurance company, and we take Medicare. So really what comes out of the patient's pocket should be very little if they have some form of coverage.
And how many facilities are there in Southern California, having not gone to look? He's been to four. Are there 400? Are there 40? Or are there four?
Yeah, I would say close to 40 probably. I mean, just off the top of my head. I mean, there's a number of psychiatric facilities.
And who
around.
Oversees them to make sure they're from good to bad? I mean...
So JCHO, the Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Hospitals and Other Organizations, is who comes in and looks at facilities to make sure that they meet at least a certain standard.
Mm-hmm.
And then CMS, the Center for Medicare Services... also reviews hospitals.
And
so,
are there credentials or things you should be looking for that this one has this and that tells you it's better than the other one?
Filter the location.
Well, you certainly want to look at JCHO accreditation.
JCHO.
Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Hospitals and Other Organizations.
Okay.
JCHO is the big kind of organization that reviews and accredits a hospital. However, they basically say that the hospital meets a certain standard.
Right.
Normally, that's a very high standard, though, that they require. But they're looking at the services that are provided. They're looking at the safety of the facility. They're not looking at whether or not it's 3 patients to a room or 4 patients to a room,
right,
or it's a single.
So again, we you need to do your own due diligence. So, you know, we start off saying that, you know, like things like ADA, for example, handicap accessibility, there's a minimum compliance.
So does it
sounds
meet
like
the minimum,
sort of maybe an overall evaluation, but if you meet that minimum compliance, then you're covered.
So let me ask the caller here, before you, I knew you were going to say something. How did you pick these hospitals? You went through 4 of them.
Well, a lot of them were just kind of like well-known like area hospitals, so we were kind of just trying.
You look them up on the internet, the doctor tell you to look at them, they give you a list. Well, how do you find them? And how did you pick one?
Online, like a Google search.
Google search.
Okay. You had
I was going to say we started the show off talking about senior facilities and how there's the minimum amount that accreditation or so every hospital that's out there now has Joint Commission accreditation.
They meet the minimum.
They really have to.
Right.
Otherwise, you can't take insurance of any kind and their business would go away.
Right.
So But, you know, this facility we built, it was initially purpose-built for research. So we built it to a standard that was for people that were going to have much longer length of stay, that were going to be participating in a study. And so, you know, it was, you know, the private rooms and a really a much level, a much higher level of service. And then we realized, hey, this is something we'd like to offer to more people than just the people participating in research. Then, you know, we got Joint Commission accredited. We accept Medicare and about 25 different types of insurance. I think, fair to say that there isn't anybody around that has a facility that's like ours, because we could be more dollars efficient with our space.
Yes.
We could put a lot more people in the amount of space that we have. And if talking to a business that's just about the bottom line in dollars and cents, why would they not do that?
Well, they're going to maximize. I mean, it's like any kind of development. At that point, you're building something that's going to maximize square footage. You're going to basically put in the bare minimum, you know, the minimums that you need to do, and then, you know, control costs, basically, because you're money-driven. No, that's a very, very important point. Thanks, Jack, for sharing that. I think that that goes across the board on any kind of care facility, any kind of senior facility.
You talk about that design all the time. Your principal business designing...
We touched on it when I first came in.
Health spas and high-end things, and their principal theory is, how much per square foot can I get a return on this? And you're saying, but you got to create some ambiance.
Forget
about
even the care model. Look at just the retail model, right? I mean, we're in Southern California. You have things that are basically malls that are basically maximized real estate, okay, at top dollar, all enclosed. And then you got people, for example, like my buddy Shaheen, who basically has the lab and the camp, and they developed the packing house in Anaheim.
Right.
The approach from day one, and it goes back to that key principle: how you ask the question predetermines the answer you're going to get, right? If you go in and you basically set it up as being, this is what's driving me, this is the vision, this is in the care facilities, this is the care level or the direction that I want to take it, this is the population I want to serve, then every decision you make to build that business plan, the facility
derives
from that. And the trick becomes not losing focus of that through the process, because that's easily done through things like value engineering and reevaluation of business, market conditions, all this stuff. At the end of the day, that is really the sustainable differentiator. If you actually stick true to that and you develop that, and there is enough of a business plan to sustain it, that is really over time what makes you a leader in the industry, an innovator in the industry.
I agree.
It applies to all industries.
So before
super critical when it comes to the care.
Before we let our caller go, I'm going to ask the representative, the doctor, and his partner here to take your facility out of it. This isn't just about an ad for your facility. I'm anywhere else in the country here. How does this caller find a facility?
How do you filter to
better
that?
Than the four crappy
Who helps
ones
you
he's
do
gone
that?
To here?
Yeah. So,
wait. Go ahead. I mean, I would say call. You know what's interesting is if you call a facility and you see how they answer the phone, how willing they are to talk to you and answer your questions.
So true.
You know, think with your instincts. If you call and it's a disinterested person that's in a hurry and says, "Yeah, hold on a minute," and they just throw you on hold, and you're on hold for 5 minutes before somebody actually talks to you,
chances are they're not going to respond to you when you're in need.
Any place you'd have people go look, they're out. Again, this isn't about your. We're going to take your place off the table here. If they weren't going to go to your facility, how would you recommend to friends and family to go find another facility?
It does depend on insurance. So, unfortunately, if somebody has Medicaid alone, Medi-Cal alone, there are real limits to where they can go. And then, you know, you're talking about med-surg facilities, and you have a limited number of places. If the person has private insurance or Medicare, it's a longer list of facilities, and some of those are nicer. Right. We don't take Medi-Cal. That's the one insurance we don't take. We're not allowed to. Only med-surg facilities are allowed to. But, you know, St. Joe's is fantastic. UCI is fantastic. You know, and, I mean, if it were my loved one, I would certainly look at St. Joe's as someplace that I would consider. It's big. And so, you know, they do quality work. They have great doctors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at a facility and how hard it is for a doctor to get privileged, how selective they are about who the physicians are.
Right.
You know, UCI, you have to be an A-list doctor to even be there.
How would what was your name, caller again?
Jack. Oh, me. No, I thought you were,
Mike.
What's your caller's name?
Mike,
Mike. So how would Mike know if they have, if it's difficult to get privileges there? How would Mike know any of that? Mike could call up and ask. I love that one. What else can Mike do tomorrow to find a good facility.
So the one thing we haven't talked about here is there is a national organization, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, where somebody can get involved. And what I would say is call and talk to NAMI as well, because those are individuals that have had loved ones that have been hospitalized.
Real stories.
Find out where they've had good experiences, because they're, I think, more than happy to share their good experiences as well as their bad experiences.
Right.
So you know, it doesn't matter where you are in the country, if you have a loved one that needs to be hospitalized, call your local NAMI office. It's nationwide.
Okay.
And they'll help out.
Have you ever called them, Mike?
No, I haven't, but that's actually a good resource.
All right, call them, and then Jack saying, and if nothing else, once they give you one, call up and see how you feel. Do they treat you? Do they answer your questions? Because if they don't talk to you, and if they're in a hurry, they're probably not going to spend much time with you.
By the way, the phone test is critical. In fact, it speaks a lot to the operational training on the backside, because good calls on the front desk, yes, have to do with the person answering the phone, but many times it has to do with how well trained they are.
And how staffed
well staffed they are. I know on the hospitality side of things, that's exactly what it is. You pick up a phone, and I know this is sort of a completely off-the-topic example, but you pick up the phone, you call a hotel, and it's a 3-star hotel, and they say, hi, da-da-da. It's very nice, courteous, hi, how can I help you? You call a 5-star hotel, and they say, how may I be of service? Very simple, but it actually projects a completely different thing. And that, how may I be of service? And if you call them 3 times and you get the same kind of quality response, that isn't because that particular person is a good guy who is having a great day. That's because they drummed it in and trained and trained and trained, and that goes up the chain all the way through how they delivered the
service.
And
all the way down the chain to the lowest person.
Down, exactly.
All right, any other questions we can do for you, America? We gave you a resource, we gave you a call test, and we gave you a couple of resources. And definitely check out their hospital, but he said St. Joe's another one. Have you ever tried that one?
No, I have not tried that one.
All right, so we gave you a couple of the resources here and a national thing. Anything else you, before we hang up here, anything else you'd love to? You got a rare chance to ask him whatever you want. Ask him here.
Well, actually, I know you said it before, but is there any way that you could give the number to Ocean View one more time?
Sure, I'll go ahead and do that, Mike.
Not without charging a lot for the time here on the show.
Ignore Paul. I ignore him too. Okay, the number for Ocean View Psychiatric Health Facility is 844-562-1212. The website is ovphf.com. And they're located at 2600 Redondo Avenue, Suite 500, Long Beach.
Okay.
Okay, sounds good.
Let us know how it turns out, Mike.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, right. Thank you very much for all the information.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I wish we could do this all day, but we've extended another half hour. I think we have to call it here. Let's just thank everybody for spending the time here today. This has been really informative. Every week on the show, we get people come in and tell the most amazing stories. And the more they really get real, I try and start the trend, but if we all get real and tell what's really going on, I find there's a real interest in talking about these things. But so few of us know where to go, who to talk to, how to handle these things. They come up upon us, and we're alone.
Yeah, and I want to thank everybody who called in today and shared. I know it's not easy, even with the
anonymity. You're what makes the show work. Yeah.
And the anonymity of the call, being on the phone, but I really appreciate that because it means a lot. I think you guys probably don't realize you probably helped a lot of people that were listening or will listen in the future because this will be saved and available.
Lots of other people
are
saying
this is common questions that people have, and sometimes they can't even ask them within their own families. And it's really true that you don't know where to go. So if we were able to help you, please let us know and come back and share what your experience is, because I think that's also part of the
story. And tell others that this forum exists, because we're always, this is sort of grows virally.
Whatever you do, hopefully you're encouraged to actually do talk to people about this. You're not alone. None of us can deal with this on our own. So,
all right,
and I want to thank everybody in the studio. Thank you guys for being here and sharing.
I'd say give out the phone number. We've done it so many times. Oh, my goodness.
Give out the phone number for CNS.
Phone number is 1-866-7-TRIALS.
And Jack, what's the address, the website?
CNSTrial.com, CNSTRIAL. Dot com.
And you guys, are you affiliated with this other hospital, or is this something another facility you guys own, or how, what's the connection between this and Ocean?
Yeah, so it's a subsidiary, so we operate the hospital separately, it's a subsidiary of CNS. We just try to really focus. CNS is focused on research.
Right. Okay.
Thank you guys very much. This is the second time we've had CNS on the show.
I'm going to call up this Ocean View.
Later. I'm going to call Ocean View on you, actually.
we can help him.
You know what? Bless you. No, bless you, because everybody, there's a going theme going on of late. People show up, and Paul does this, you know, therapy session, and then everybody, as they leave, says, you know, we can help him.
Yeah. Can't make any promises.
And yeah, you know, I wouldn't put that on you, actually.
And this is a bad joke, and I hope nobody takes it in poor taste, but, you know, they always used to say, I don't have Alzheimer's, I just have sometimers. So, anyway.
Well, we appreciate you, Paul, and hopefully, you know, that everybody out there got something out of the show. We, you know, call us. Let us know. I'll give my information, too. My cell phone number is 949-212-8299. You can reach me on Gmail at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantus, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, at gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook. We really want to hear if these shows are helping, or if you have any topics you want us to address. We pretty much are shameless. We'll talk about anything.
Well, this is a campfire where everybody can gather every week and tell stories and share resources and ask questions and commiserate. That's what all these shows on OC Talk Radio are built around, and this campfire happens to be around aging.
We don't do screaming talk radio here. We do streaming.
Streaming, not screaming. All
right. Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.